Cruz will be our final speaker, and then we'll open it up for discussion with all of you. Will Masters joined the faculty at Tufts University in 2010, where he conducts research and teaches on food policy, including production, markets, and trade. He's taught previously in the Department of Agricultural Economics at Purdue University in Indiana, University of Zimbabwe, and Columbia University. Recent publications include an undergraduate textbook on economics of agricultural development, and much to my pleasure, research on determinants of child nutrition. So that's really wonderful to see. He is the International Fellow of the African Association of Agricultural Economics, and through this year will be the editor for the Journal of Agricultural Economics.
So thanks, Grace. So we're at the nearing the end of just amazingly rich and diverse day of rapid-fire presentations. My job is to try to say something new in the context of that, to try to knit us back all the way to David Morley's, for me, very inspirational talk last night, and then to lead into the grassroots action discussion that comes next. And I want to try to do this by knitting together the short-term volatility to the long-term trends in the outlook for this child nutrition issue that is at the heart of food security and food insecurity, and in the region that's most vulnerable today, which is in Africa. So here's the situation we're in now, two spikes, and the possibility of a plateau. People often think about food price trends, but as you'll see, in the long run, we really have plateaus and then spikes. And the question is, what's the next plateau? Do we move to a low-price regime or to a high-price regime after these two or perhaps more spikes? And the question of response is really a very human, psychological one, of producers responding with investment, consumers responding with substitution signals, activists and officials. And you can think of the history of this in the recent headlines, the G20 responding, G8 responding, to the 2008 crisis, the 2011 price spike being quite important, I think, for the story of the Arab Spring. And this headline about food riots in Algeria, as you may know, Algeria in the Arab Spring is, in a sense, the dog that didn't bark, right? Because the Algerian government responded to the popular uprising with a lot of measures that reduced the price of food and improved welfare for Algerians as compared to other North African and Arab countries that didn't. So what can we learn from history? And by history, I mean literally history. This is a remarkable kind of data. And throughout these few minutes, I'm going to show you a bunch of different kinds of new data that I don't think you've seen before. In this case, this is literally history. This is written down history. This is the words in books that, as you probably know, a large fraction of which have been scanned by Google and made searchable. And then the n-grams feature of Google allows you to search for the frequency with which any sequence of terms arise in the written record in the English language. And here we have, since the beginning of the 20th century, 1900 on the far left, the share of all two-word phrases in all scanned English language books that say the words food crisis in blue. And you see that spiking, and with increasing frequency, people writing and talking about food crises up to the middle peak there, which happens to be 1980. And then in the red, you have the two-word phrase farm crisis. What you'll notice is that you have food crises, the blue spikes, that then abate, and then there's a period in which people don't talk much about food crises, and then you have a farm crisis, right? And then you have another alternation between food crisis and farm crisis. It kept going until about 1970. Then you had the Green Revolution. You had the price spike and the food crisis of the 1940s, 40s and 50s, and then the food price spike and food crisis concerns of the late 60s, and then the price spike in 1973. And then this Green Revolution that led to a period of very little concern, and then a big spike in farm crisis talk around late 1980s. And then this astonishing period that we've talked about so far is this period of low food prices and so forth. I call it here the Great Forgetting, in which both food crisis and farm crisis just disappeared from the agenda, fell down both dramatically together. Let's match it up to food prices. And what you see is each food price spike on the lower part of the chart matching up to a period of food crisis, and then low prices, a period of farm crisis. And so what you see is these matching up, and this great forgetting or the complacency of the 1990 to 2008 period associated with this historically low price level. And the question, of course, is will we respond now as we did then? And by what I mean in particular is the big food crisis of the end of World War I, in the United States here, House and Senate debate food riots, in Japan, likewise. That, of course, led to the land-grant agricultural research system in the United States and the Japanese agricultural experiment station system that propelled those countries through the 20th century. And then the food riots of India, this headline from 1973 in April, led, of course, to South Asian Green Revolution. And the question is, will we do now what they did then? And most remarkably, even with the astonishing fruits of the Green Revolution, and by that I mean the Green Revolution writ large, not the narrow sense of just high-yielding rice and wheat and fertilizer, but the investments in agricultural productivity more generally. So even at the all-time low prices of 2002, you have this remarkable headline, at that time remarkable, 815 million by the FAO calorie undernourishment standard. And so that's what I want to talk about for a moment now. And what's interesting about that in nutritional terms is that when you turn the overall calorie deficits of the FAO, 815, or now then 925, and potentially over 1 billion people, if you look at where that manifests itself in measurable declines in body weight relative to a person's biological norm or biological growth potential, what you find is that that happens in this astonishingly narrow window of time in a person's life. It happens in the narrow window of time as breast milk starts to become a smaller and smaller fraction of the child's nutritional needs as they grow past 4 to 6 to 8 months, until they can start digesting enough of a low-calorie density family diet when they need, have unusually high-cost, high-quality food needs. That's when you see, in the green line and the orange line here, this decline in body weight relative to the child's height by their genetic potential. And that's the period of nutritional insult in a medical sense and in a moral sense that food is most lacking in human development. Of course, the heights here are... This is measured weight relative to height. Height is also declining, and stunting is a major issue. Stunting, however, is more closely related to a whole lot of other things that are causing stunting, including in gestation before birth, and then micronutrients and so forth. But the sheer lack of food that leads infants prior to the age of 2 years to have becoming thinner and thinner and thinner in infancy is this astonishing problem, which was most severe, as shown in this slide, in Asia. So this chart is taking the national surveys of underweight for children. It includes an older age range where data are, and it's weight relative to age in this case, so you're getting both height deficits, stunting, and wasting, or the thinness of children. What you're seeing is countries back in the in the 1970s having 50-60% of children underweight. This is now in Asia. And all that falling really very sharply, with improvements here in the fraction, the prevalence rates, cutting those prevalence rates in some cases in half from the 70s, the period of food crisis headlines, to which these governments and our governments responded with massive investments that created the Green Revolution and rural development, those malnutrition rates falling in half, of course, absolute numbers falling less quickly than that because of total population growth, that remarkable achievement happening in Africa only recently. So in part, that's because these African countries, and here we're looking at Eastern and Central African countries, are starting, as you can see, from a much lower level of total undernutrition. They had, in the 70s, they had much more land per household and much less undernutrition relative to the Asian headlines of food crisis in the 70s and 60s. And those African undernutrition rates actually rose in the 70s and 80s, but have, in many of these countries illustrated here and in other countries as well, begun to decline since 2000. So as we move from the long-term history, response to price volatility through investments and the decline that we saw in South Asia, and we ask about the outlook in Africa, the crucial context of purchasing power, real incomes, and poverty rates is really dramatically illustrated by this picture. And the point that food insecurity and undernutrition, and including particularly child and early infant undernutrition, is fundamentally a matter of household capabilities, household entitlements, household livelihoods, all as measured by household poverty. That was extremely high in Asia, in the white bar, the East Asian, the light blue bar, the South Asian households, above 60% in the early 80s in both cases. But fueled by the Green Revolution, having this remarkable decline in poverty rates that's associated with the decline in malnutrition rates in Asia that you saw before, is being in some sense echoed in Africa, but 20 years later. So what you see here is the rise in poverty rates in Africa, even as Asian rates were declining, happening in a kind of wave pattern with Africa something like 20 years later in time. We see the same phenomenon tracked in terms of a Green Revolution indicator, which is share of land in new varieties, about 20 years later for Africa than for Asia. The pattern is really pretty similar in the sense of crop varieties coming from public agricultural research systems through international exchange to get traits that work well in the local area. As Mark Rosegrant clearly and others have explained earlier, Africa being quite different, needing its own varieties, can't just use someone else's. And a lot of this is back to demography, back to the demographic transition and to the decline in child mortality that led to a kind of baby boom, right, from child survival, not increased fertility, not increased births, but increased survival of those who were born, that began to happen in Africa after World War II, and after, especially after independence in the early 60s, that had happened in South Asia and 15, 20 years earlier, and in East Asia a few decades before that. So that here that's tracked by the fraction of the population that is children. In this case, children or the elderly, but it's child dependency that's driving this. That you see the fraction of people who are children rising still in Africa through to 1990 and only declining in the recent period, whereas it had declined roughly 20 years earlier in South Asia. So Africa had the world's most severe demographic burden, about half of people all being children, at its peak in 1990. Now this demographic gift that Africa is experiencing of a falling share of people who are children, that same demographic gift had been experienced in Asia some years earlier. Equally dramatically, the exact same pattern in rural population growth. So from year to year, how many more children, people are there in your village in your district. That increased at a very rapid rate, at an increasing rate, as the demographic transition began, and then as people are absorbed to the cities and fertility rates fall, those rates eventually decline. Eventually, they decline to below zero, where you have more land available from year to year per farmer. Africa, having had over 2% annual growth in rural populations for 30 years, an astoundingly long, far longer period of time than South Asia had ever experienced, or East Asia. But then that decline happening in a way that it had happened earlier in Asia. So this exact same pattern occurring again. So in conclusion, you've got this short-term volatility leading to policy response that determines how you take advantage or don't of these long-term trends. This sort of two-spike, new plateau world, where we're not sure whether the new plateau will be high or low, but it'll probably be high, as unless the high productivity growth scenario of Mark Rosegrant comes to pass. It all depends on whether increased public investment actually deepens and broadens and extends and enriches this green revolution to more and more crops, micronutrients, environmental sustainability, water use efficiency, and so forth, all the things that we've talked about. Child nutrition and extreme poverty in a chronic sense is a bigger thing than that volatility. It occurred even when world food prices were extremely low. But the long-term trends promise this wave of improvement. It happens slowly. We know it happens slowly because of the experience of Asia. We know it matters, happens, depends on history. Africa's entering this period much later. It involves a worsening and then improvement in these core trends. But Africa has begun to put, so the context for this grassroots activism discussion after the break, and for all of us, I think, after this meeting, is a world in which there is enormous potential for improvement from year to year to year. In any area in Africa where you care to work, there are horrible, horrible conditions and volatility and risk and not only the natural, but the social conflict issues that we've talked about from yesterday evening with David Morley's presentation, but this wave of improvement is the backdrop against which we can all work. Thanks very much.